Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. My name is Rin Veith, and I'm a host on the Human Rights Channel. Today, we have Alora Hanum Chowdhury here to discuss her new book, Ethical Encounters, Transnational Feminism, Human Rights, and War Cinema in Bangladesh. Alora Hanum Chowdhury is a professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So to start, I'm curious as to how you came to write this book in the first place. This is something that you touch on a little bit in both your acknowledgments, which are just beautiful, as well as the prologue to this book. So what brought you to this particular book project?
Yes, and thank you again for hosting me today. It's a pleasure to be here. As I talk about in the prologue, I grew up in the shadow of the war and within a nationalist family who endured the various vicissitudes of the war and in a very personal way. So it, for my generation, I would say that we grew up with stories, media representations, just a lot of conversations about what our parents' generations went through during the war. And with my family, I want to mention that my father was an academic and an intellectual and always talked about within his circle of associates and friends about what nation building means and the various political and activist experiences that they had during the war. And at the same time, I would be privy to all these conversations among women in my family, my mother, my aunts, who would always narrate what it meant to live through this very violent, traumatic time on a day-to-day basis. And it really was quite a contrast in terms of hearing the stories about the political involvement of multi-dimensional men in the war, but also the women's stories, which were more about the human experience of war. And in these experiences, what really stood out to me was that there were no clear-cut victims and perpetrators, or that it was a people's war in the sense that it touched wide swaths of populations, and that it also left this very lasting legacy in the way that we see ourselves as a post-war, post-1971 generation, a generation that is very actively thinking about what it means to be Bengali.
So you focus on a select number of films in this book, and I'm curious how you determines which films to focus on. How you made those choices.
Right. I think, the book, it really looks at this notion of an encounter, right? So it's a feminist engagement and with encounters with the reckoning in the form of film, particularly in the ongoing aftermath of this extraordinarily violent and traumatic and complex birth of a liberation movement, or Mukti Juddho, that resulted in the creation of Bangladesh as a nation in 1971. And Bangladesh has a very rich history of filmmaking about the war. So I talk about the films that were made prior to 1971, during 1971, and post 1971. And even as the war was unfolding, we have freedom fighters like Zahir Raihan and Alamgir Kobir and Babul Chowdhury, who were commissioned by the government at that time to document this humanitarian crisis that was unfolding in South Asia. So we have documentaries like Stop Genocide, which looks at not only what was happening in the subcontinent in terms of mass violations of human rights, but also it brought in this sort of global critique of the United States, for instance, in supporting West Pakistan and the United Nations, how it failed to acknowledge this atrocity that was unfolding. And also immediately after the war, it is really unusual that in 1972 itself, we see four feature films being released about the war. And the directors, even the cast and crew, were often freedom fighters themselves. And so, for instance, this iconic film, Ora Agarojon, or, They Were 11, which was the first commercially released film about the 1971 war, featured freedom fighters. The film director himself was a freedom fighter. So we have this sort of whole genre of film that has an aura of authenticity stamped onto them, because of not only the subject matter in the immediate aftermath of the war and during the war, but also because of who was making them. But what we see that even while these films were in a way made and circulated to raise awareness about this relatively unknown in the global context, humanitarian crisis in South Asia. At the same time, it set up these very rigid categories through which to look at the war. So we have this, mass killings, the heroic freedom fighters, the violence, the murders, the arson, the looting, and also what we see is women were portrayed as mostly in minor roles, but usually they entered this whole discourse through the lens of sexual violence. And what women's film in particular in Bangladesh in this context has done is really push those limited representations and opened up a way to think about suffering and the violence inflicted, but in a more structural way, and that continues in the everyday. So their lives go largely unspoken, except for in these films, that are willing to help us see them in a more multidimensional way. So film in this context is a really what, you know, Pakistani film historian Nasreen Rahman calls a multi-sensory archive. It's a unique and a very important archive that helps us think about the notions of witness and complicate the work of silence in films in post-1971 Bangladesh.
One of the big threads in this book is your consideration of national cinema. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit to what you see national cinema is in this context, because it feels very important, and also how your analysis of national cinema really unsettles these binary assumptions of women's experiences. And here I'm thinking of, you know, throughout the book, you break down these binaries between like oppression, resistance, things like that.
Right. I draw on this notion of national cinema from the work of Catherine Massoud and Tariq Massoud, who are really important filmmakers in Bangladesh. And they demonstrate how national cinema is constitutive of the founding moment of a nation, but also what we consider constitutive of a national culture, a memory, and identity. And what I try to do in the film is really broaden that sense of national cinema and how in Bangladesh it captures the particularities of the war and the post-1971 identity making, but also how that cannot be looked at without a broader trans-regional and even transnational history making of decolonization and movements for liberation. And within national cinema, as we know, nationalism itself has its exclusions. And the nationalist cinema in Bangladesh also is premised upon a number of exclusions. So the production of the cinema happening within a kind of a middle class urban based movement that has come to define what national liberation has meant for Bangladesh. And this very kind of heteronormative middle class masculine experience then that defines the struggle for self-determination. And women's cinema in this particular kind of a context then really enables the production of a oppositional as well as a counter narrative to these exclusionary stories, and also to really think about the multiple subjectivities that are not captured within a nationalist frame and even a frame of human rights, which is another area that I engage in conversation with nationalism and how it helps us think about alternative ways of thinking about the human beyond what post-colonial and enlightenment notions of humanity allows us to do.
So building on that, perfect segue, because my next question is about human rights cinema. So as well as national cinema, you speak to this idea of human rights cinema. And for those who might not be familiar with this framing, how do you see human rights cinema, and how is this a useful category for you in this project?
Right. I think, you know, it's a really useful category in thinking about ways in which women filmmakers in particular, as well as women-centric cinema about the war, has conceptualized ideas about gender and sexuality and also agency. And, you know, when I think particularly about the certain tropes through which war cinema has gained this kind of place in the national imagination about what it means to be Bengali and what the struggle for self-determination entailed, looking at ways that filmmakers like Rubaiyat Hossain, for instance, in the film Meher Jaan, which is a film that came out in 2010, represents women's subjectivity. It really, at the one hand, disrupts the nationalist tellings of women's roles in the cinema, but it also disrupts the way that women's sexual subjectivity has been constructed within the nation, and what are the legible forms through which we come to understand victimhood and agent within a particular context of national suffering. So for instance, in this film, we have a number of female characters, including a survivor of sexual violence, Neela, and we also have a war child who was born of rape during the war, and who was later on given up in adoption to a foreign family, who returns to the nation in search of truth, in search of her identity. And both of these depictions open up new ways of thinking about citizenship and women's agency. So, for instance, the character of Neela in the film talks about how the violence that she has endured during the war, and while she was in a camp held captive by Pakistani soldiers, and the experience of sexual violence was not the only time that she has experienced violence in her life. So it connects wartime violence with non-wartime violence. And aesthetically speaking, the film also is a war film, but however, it does not show any of the violences of war visually. However, when we see the construction of these characters like Neela or the war child who has returned to the nation in search of her identity, the trauma, the aesthetics of trauma is very much omnipresent in the film, in various ways, in the way that the characters speak about their past, also in terms of the sound and the lighting and the music, the use of all of these to really create what a Palestinian film scholar Hamid Dabashi has called a traumatic realism, and how that these films have aesthetically woven into them this notion of a sublated violence, a violent past that hasn't really been reckoned with fully. And so it's very much immersed within this aesthetic of trauma as a whole. And what we also see is that this particular film was met with a lot of resistance in Bangladesh, and audiences coming from various walks of life were very disturbed by this depiction of wartime violence as not the only time that women have perhaps experienced sexual violence, and the response being that this is somehow diminishing the violences that happened during the war. And of course, the also the representation of the survivor of sexual violence in the film has been criticized in the way that that how a lot of critics found the character to be very bold and very expressive, and both in the way that she spoke, also the way that she was dressed, that she was somehow considered not to be an authentic victim and therefore not worthy of empathy. And I think, you know, I draw on scholars, particularly Black feminist scholars, who have talked about this notion of suffering and trauma, and the in light of the legacy of enslavement, and how Black women in popular culture tend to be represented through these ideas of the controlling image, Patricia Hill Collins's notion of the controlling image, that they are categorically represented as victimized, and as and Black women's sexuality in particular is then used as a site of construction by the state and popular media as a site of abjection, and various kinds of discourses of nationalism, state violence, religiosity. These are contested through the way that women's bodies become the very site of contestation of these, how these discourses play out. And so I use these ideas to think about how in Bangladeshi war cinema also, women's subject positions have been created through these very rigid ideas about what and how a victim should look like, and also how they should speak about their suffering and their struggles. And in what it allows me to do is by engaging in this critique of women filmmakers' diverse representations of women's roles in the war, it expands our in a way, our visual understanding, and expands our feminist looking into these topics in a way that defies the colonial and enlightenment discussions around humanity and agency.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So to ask you a question about something that you just mentioned, a little bit of a longer question, but you engage a lot with Black feminist scholarship. And something, it seemed particularly salient to me that you're really engaging with this Black feminist scholarship, particularly around ideas of surveillance and control. Here I'm thinking of your engagement with Patricia Hill Collins, thinking through rape and lynching as an institutionalized practice aimed at oppressing Black people, so not just gender rights, gender and race. And this also came up in terms of racialization. As you write on page 175, technologies of racialization dispose of bodies, appropriate them as products, and fix them within a visual grid. And so I would love to hear more about how Black feminist scholarship helped you explore and engage with these ideas of, you know, not just surveillance and control, but also, you know, surveillance and control.
Right. So I draw on a Black feminist analysis of essentially what it means to be human and ways of living that is not always recognizable through an Enlightenment and post-colonial framework of humanity that has come to dominate human rights paradigms when we engage visually or politically with instances of suffering or struggle or decolonization movements. And so in the work that some of the filmmakers have done in Bangladesh, we see this expansion of the notion of humanity come into light. So if you look at the film Shadhinota, or A Certain Liberation, made by filmmaker Yasmin Kabir, it tells the story of, again, a survivor of the war, Gurudashi Mondol, who is an elderly woman who, at the time, living in Khulna district. And interestingly enough, in the film, we see that she is not represented or talked about as being a Birangana woman. Now, Birangana, the title itself, it means a courageous woman or a war heroine. And it was a honorific that was bestowed on women survivors of sexual violence in the immediate aftermath of the war by the government of Bangladesh in a really globally unprecedented gesture. In a post-conflict situation to recognize the roles and particularly the sacrifices that women have made in nationalist struggles, in enabling the nation to emerge as independent. And what we have seen that also in post-war Bangladesh, this honorific has also further stigmatized women, such that many women did not want to be associated with that title because it meant further rejection from the community and their families. And in this film, what we see is Guru Dashimandal, the protagonist around whom the film is constructed. She really defies these categorization in many ways. So the film opens with some historic footage of what nationalist leaders have promised the nation and promised the ordinary people of Bangladesh for their sacrifice in the war. And that is juxtaposed by Guru Dashimandal herself directly engaging the filmmakers and asking them why they are even having this conversation with her, and if they have been sent by these same nationalist leaders who we see making these very powerful statements about the freedom that all citizens of Bangladesh have enjoyed as a result of this war and the various kinds of sacrifices. And we also see that the community members that she lives among address her as someone who is a good woman, someone who is a loving mother, someone who may be a mad woman. So in various terms, but neither Guru Dashimandal nor anybody in the community necessarily refers to her as a Birangana woman. And what it really alludes to is that how the way that women have, particularly survivors of the war, have been memorialized and also integrated into the story of national liberation is incomplete. It doesn't really capture the various dimensions of women's struggle, including sexual violence, but also structural violence of other sorts, and also in not fully recognizing in the ways in which that women perhaps want to be integrated in the national story. So, for instance, one of the things that Guru Dashimandal asserts in the film is that she wants to sit down with the prime minister and share, in an attempt to share some of the burden that of pain that she lives with. And we also see in the film that she is dressed in sort of the colors of the national flag and is wearing this cap that says victory to Bangladesh. And she makes this attempt to go and see the prime minister when she happens to be in her town for a rally commemorating the war. And there is an image of Guru Dashimandal in the film looking at the camera across these bars, these very sort of, you know, prison-like bars. And she talks about how she was held back from meeting with the prime minister and sharing this burden of a pain that she carries with her, and that may have been lessened if somebody actually sat down and listened to her experience. What we also see in another really extraordinarily illuminating moment in the film is the way in which Guru Dashimandal implicates the viewer and the filmmaker in a gesture of witness and also alliance making to come with her in this journey. And so instead of being someone who is being represented, she is very much part of this multidimensional process of the storytelling, in which she is encouraging viewers and filmmakers themselves to be integrated in that journey in producing something that might be broadening the notions of humanity and subjectivity. And I think that this expansion of what it means to be human is really very importantly demonstrated in Black feminist theory. And I'm also thinking about the work of Saidiya Hartman, who has talked about reading the silences in archives and this idea of a critical fabulation that perhaps enables readers and scholars and witnesses to think about ways that are not always commensurable or capturable in narratives of national liberation and women's emancipation, but to take a pause and to really think about the silences in a generative way. And I think that women's cinema in Bangladesh, in both its aesthetics and political vision, helps us realize that.
So I was really struck while reading your wonderful book about the differences between gendered experiences of the nation, as you write on page 85, which I love that phrase. And then also how this is quite different from woman as nation, that sort of symbolism. And I was wondering how you see these differences within the frame of visual culture, because it seems like a lot of this book is really, it's really unsettling some of these, again, like binary symbolic assumptions. And I'm also thinking in terms of some of the pushback that you note to some of these films.
Right. I mean, I think that, again, it goes back to this very rigid ways that we have come to understand the struggle for liberation, and that what feminist scholars really help us open up that conversation. So, for instance, Anne McClintock talks about all nationalisms are violent. And, you know, if you look at also transnational feminist scholars who have talked about how women's bodies are sites of embodied knowledge production in the context of conflict and war and trauma, and I'm particularly thinking about Latin American feminist scholars who've also really furthered our understanding of this phenomenon of knowledge emanating from an experience of trauma. And I think that the genre of film that I engage with really draws from those lessons and illuminate a different kind of feminist knowledge making. And I'm thinking of this documentary film called Born Together by Shabnam Ferdowsi, in which she traces the stories of a number of children of war. And one in particularly, Monwara Clark, who returns to Bangladesh in search of a birth certificate, in search of her roots, in search of her mother. And again, she, as part of the post-war policy of foreign adoption of children who were born of rape during 1971, she was also adopted by a Canadian family. And she talks about how the imprint of the war is very much part of her, not only her memory and of her identity, but literally it's imprinted on her body. So she talks about how her mother was struck by a bayonet by a Pakistani soldier, and while Monwara Clark was still in her mother's womb. And so that imprint from that strike is on her body. And it is a way that her subjectivity has emerged out of that trauma, and that her positionality as a survivor of war who has been given up by the nation of Bangladesh, and the kinds of violences that has enacted on women in multiple registers, and how that continues to enact different forms of violence on different generations of survivors of the war, and how that should be folded into the story of the nation, and in our also attempts to recognize the citizenship of the children of war who have not been granted that, So I think, again, this idea of binary ways of thinking about the nation in terms of agent and victim and perpetrator and violence, even emancipation and oppression, are really opened up by the questions that are raised in these films. And also it gives us a way to think about an embodied feminist knowledge production and an aspiration towards justice, as I talk about in the film, that these are all really justice-seeking films, and also what that justice should look like is very much informed by these layering of violent encounters, but also that how engaging with this kind of an encounter of feminism and humanity and visual practices, that we might be thinking of justice in a different way.
So I could speak with you for hours about this book, but we are unfortunately approaching the end. And so I have one more question for you about this book before we close. You start the epilogue of this book with a very provocative question that I've just been sitting with for weeks. Why does human rights discourse collect narratives of pain, and why do viewers need them in order to prove harm was done? Page 178 ends. You note a number of different instances where, you know, people are resistant or have strong reactions to some of the films that you discuss. But you also note some other examples of when, for example, people, women, I should say, who believe that they're going to meet, you know, government representatives are instead pushed to give testimony about horrible things that happened to them during the war. And so, yeah, I would just be curious to you know, just because I have the honor and privilege of speaking with you today, to flip that question back towards you, and to ask you, you know, why does human rights discourse collect narratives of pain, and why do viewers need them in order to prove harm was done? How do you see that question?
Right, that's a really critical question in the book, and I think what I'm thinking about is the way that silence and speech have come to serve within the whole industry of human rights, and how silence and speech then also govern and discipline the ways in which that witnesses and subjects of human rights are able to articulate their experience or not. And really thinking through the whole human rights industry in Bangladesh and their engagement with women victims on a number of fronts. And I'm thinking particularly about, again, the film Born Together, which brings to light the routine ways that war has been memorialized in various public forums, and that survivors of war are called upon to give testimonials for various state representatives or national and international human rights institutions, representatives, to tell a particular story about the war. And again, that these frames do not quite capture the complexity and the subjectivity of survivors. And I look at one particular example of a war child who is an adult male, and he accompanies his mother to an event in Dhaka City held at the press club. And it is quite stark that Sudhir Borman, this young man, is shown seated in a row of empty seats at the back of the auditorium, and juxtaposed that with a panel of experts on a stage who are going to be talking about justice for war victims. And he's summoned at one point to come on stage and talk about his experience. And he talks about growing up poor and destitute and not having a father, and what that has meant for him at a psychological, in the psychological realm, but also in the social and economic realm. And he walks off stage with tears in his eyes behind the panel of experts. And it's a very telling moment, I think, that captures how the human rights paradigm and also institutions use survivors, narratives, and stories and silence in instrumental ways to further a narrative of savior and victimization, where again the complex humanity of individuals are not quite engaged with in a full dimension. And so I think, you know, it speaks to the Enlightenment ideas of pain and suffering, and how those must be alleviated through certain mechanisms. And these mechanisms might be, you know, truth and reconciliation, vehicles, and that survivors can enunciate their pain when called upon, and that these frameworks also provide a kind of a way to what feminist scholar Noyanika Mukherjee, she calls it, it gives one a narrative license in a way to construct narratives that fits a particular intent or paradigm that has a very kind of a pack closure in, formulated within it. And so there's always, of course, ways that these silences and speech don't exceed those kinds of paradigms. And so how can we really engage with those silences and an aberrant speech that might help us think about justice in a broader way beyond these legalistic kinds of repetitive testimonial giving instances.
Thank you so much for your time today, and thank you for speaking with me about ethical encounters. Before we close, would you like to let listeners know about other projects you might be working on?
Oh, sure. So I'm continuing my work on women's cinematic narratives and looking at women's cinema and how it constructs the idea of the new Bangladeshi woman within discourses of development and globalization in post-independent Bangladesh. So I'm moving away from a nationalist framing to other kinds of broad discourses that have come to shape identity for the national subject and very sort of multidimensional, contradictory, contestatory identities of women within discourses of globalization and development in Bangladesh.
Sounds so exciting. Thank you again for speaking with me, and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you, Reen. It's been a pleasure.